Okay, so this is going to be a talk about a bunch of different work. I'm going to give the talk almost exactly in the opposite order to which the work was done. So starting with this, starting with this recent paper with Sergey and Frank, who are here, and then sort of working backwards to the work I did a couple of years ago. And I'd like to thank Xiaogang Wen, Toru Koma, Sergey and Frank for their collaboration on the work here. So generally, what this talk is going to be about is, why do all these simple models work for something like topological order? That is, so let me first define how I'll be discussing what topological order is in this talk. We have multiple ground states of the Hamiltonian, sine ought I, and here's a pointer. Okay. So I have some different ground states of the Hamiltonian labeled by this index I, and if you take any local operator, and I'll define this more precisely later, then the expectation value of this operator between the ground states is almost the same in all the different ground states, and it has vanishing matrix elements between the different ground states. So I've written it mathematically here up to some error that will be exponentially small in the system size. Capital L will be the system size. And there are lots of different example models that display this. Physical systems like the fractional quantum Hall effect, you have the Laughlin wave function, and you have some Hamiltonian, which gives you the Laughlin wave function exactly as its ground state. You have quantum dimer models with these equal amplitude superposition wave functions, which have the Roxar-Kivelson Hamiltonian, and then you have various more complicated models that we've been hearing about. And really the question is, every single one of these model Hamiltonians has the nice property that it's a sum of terms which exactly annihilate the ground state. And so it's easy to show that indeed the ground state is the ground state of this Hamiltonian. What about more realistic Hamiltonians? What if I take one of these Hamiltonians and deform it in some way? What will happen to the topological order in the system? What will happen to the ground states? How does this structure change in a more general kind of system? Related questions that I'll discuss are, how do you make a topologically ordered state? So if you start from some given system that's not topologically ordered and you do something to it, you physically this means you evolve it under some time-dependent Hamiltonian, but you do something to it, how long does it take to generate a topologically ordered state? Or you could say, what is the depth of the quantum circuit required to build this topologically ordered state starting from something without topological order? And as I said, we have these questions about how do these topologically ordered systems respond to perturbations, both small perturbations and then really large perturbations, where you don't just look sort of first order in perturbation theory, but you make drastic changes in the parameters of the Hamiltonian. And what happens then also, I'll discuss for ordinary order, non-topological order, how those things are stable. So as an example, for example, if you take this Roxar-Kivelson Hamiltonian with dimer states on a square lattice. On a square lattice, you find that there's this point at which there's an equal amplitude superposition. However, this is completely unstable against any perturbations. It's not even a critical point. There's some large number of relevant operators. On the other hand, on a triangular lattice, you get a gapped phase when you consider it, and you find that it's stable against perturbations. This is some example of a case where you have a known Hamiltonian, which can be the sum of projection operators. It has this wave function, and then on the square lattice, if you perturb it, it's completely unstable, and on the triangular lattice, it's very stable. So this is the kind of thing that I'd like to try to understand better in this talk. So outline of the talk, how we're going to approach this. Starting with a class of bounds called Lieb-Robinson bounds. Originally, Lieb and Robinson developed these things. I think it was back in the 60s when they first wrote their paper on it. There's been a lot of work on it recently. And basically what it tells you, physically what it tells you, there's some rigorous mathematical bounds, but physically what it tells you is that if you want to propagate information by a distance L under quantum evolution under some Hamiltonian, it takes a time that's of order L over V, where V is some characteristic velocity of this Hamiltonian. So it takes time to propagate information. Then I'm going to use these Lieb-Robinson bounds to discuss how you produce order in a system. And the first basic result will be about ordinary order, that if you start with a system without correlations, it takes a time of order L over V to produce a correlation length of order L, if you want to change the system in some way. And if you want to produce topological order, if the system has linear size capital L, it takes a time of order capital L over V under this arbitrary Hamiltonian evolution to get a topologically ordered state out. The next thing I'm going to get to is discussing, so this is discussing sort of starting with an arbitrary state and evolving it under an arbitrary Hamiltonian, and what do you get? Then I'm going to discuss starting with a gap system, and that's the ground state of some Hamiltonian, and changing the Hamiltonian slowly and discussing how the ground state evolves. And I'll show that this can be related to some local Hamiltonian evolution, and then combine it with this result to show something about the stability of topological order in these systems. And finally, I'll talk about a particular case of this quasi-adiabatic evolution for flux insertion and how you can prove higher dimensional analogs of the Lieb-Schultz-Matisse theorem. So let me start, so there's gonna be a whole bunch of different results spread out over these different papers. Let me start with these Lieb-Robinson bounds. So just a note, I'm gonna be giving everything in a very physics terms in this talk, but most of the things I say there are some very precise mathematical statements of. So if you're more curious about the rigorous statements, please come talk to me. So Lieb-Robinson bounds say something like this. Let's say we have two operators, A and B, which are separated in space by distance L. So A acts over here and B acts over here. Since they act on different sites, they commute with each other. Now, what happens if we consider something like the commutator of A of t with B? So A of t is A at a different time t, at some later time. And this is defined by the usual Heisenberg evolution of operators. So I have e to the I h of t, A e to the minus I h of t. Now, how big is this commutator? Suppose the Hamiltonian is local. Local meaning that it acts only on nearby sites. This will include potentially cases where you have exponentially decaying interactions. You have some local Hamiltonian present there. Then what this implies is that you can derive a bound on this commutator at different times. That if you take the commutator of A at time t with B, this commutator is small in the sense of operator norm if the time t is small compared to, it should be L over V. I made this up recently. This should be L over V. So if the time t is small compared to L over V, for some constant V which you can derive from the Hamiltonian, then the commutator of these two operators is small in operator norm. So here are these two operators in space. They commute with each other identically at t equals 0. As soon as t becomes non-zero, the commutator no longer identically vanishes. There's some non-vanishing commutator of these operators. However, you have to take a time t that's of order, the distance between them, in order for this commutator not to be very small in the sense of operator norm. So this is the Lieb-Robinson bound. I give the precise statement down here. So suppose you have a Hamiltonian that's a sum of terms h of z, where each of these h of z acts on some set of site z. So for example, if this is a purely local Hamiltonian, each of these h of z will involve only some finite set of sites. In the case with exponentially decaying things, the h of z may involve large numbers of sites, but the ones that involve large numbers of sites will be very small. They'll be very small terms in operator norm. And so then the precise statement is that you can bound this commutator a of t with b by some function that I call cb of x and t, where x is the set on which a is supported and t is this time. And this function cb x and t has some set of initial conditions and some wave equation. The initial conditions are that if x, which is the set a is supported on, is disjoint from the set that B is supported on Y, it vanishes because they commute at the same time. And if they're not disjoint, then the commutator is at most twice this operator norm. And then you can derive some wave equation. Yeah. This precise statement down here, which I'm giving, applies to any Hamiltonian that can be written in this form. Yes. Doesn't even need to be Euclidean. If you want to derive these kinds of things like exponentially decaying, it gets, so I'm going to finish making this precise statement. This precise statement applies to any Hamiltonian system, any dimension, doesn't even need to be Euclidean. If you want to derive things about this, you need to have some sense of what the metric is on the space. You need to have some sense of distance. And if you assume you're in a Euclidean space and these h of z have this exponentially decaying property, then this follows. So this statement is good for any Hamiltonian, any dimension with exponentially decaying interactions. This statement is good for any Hamiltonian ever. And sort of the magnitude of this velocity up here depends upon the strength and the range of these terms. So the larger the velocity is of order the strength of the interaction constants in the H times the range of these interaction constants in the H. So this velocity can be derived without knowing the exact spectrum of the H. You just need to know roughly how big the coupling constants are. What's that? X is the support at time t equals 0. Yeah, at time t equals 0, yeah. So if initially, if X and this Y, which is the support of B, if they have vanishing intersection, then at time t equals 0, this commutator is 0. Otherwise, there's some non-vanishing commutator. And then you can derive some wave equation where the commutator at time t is bounded by its commutator at time 0 plus, and then you have terms in the Hamiltonian which you have to worry about. You take look at all the terms in the Hamiltonian which have non-vanishing intersection with the set X, and then you look at the bound for that commutator with there. So the idea that what happens is you have to worry about what is the commutator of this term with this one, and you can consider different terms in the Hamiltonian, and they propagate things over, and this wave equation can be solved as an upper bound in different geometries, and you get this result. So anyway, what's that?
Your distance scale one.
My distance scale. I don't have a distance scale thus far. I mean, all that matters is deriving this velocity. Oh, you're saying what is L? Yeah, there's some lattice scale, for example. So the velocity is proportional to the range of the Hamiltonian, which is, again, defined by the distance scale. So the exact details behind it aren't so important, but the existence of this bound is the thing I wanted to mention. So how is this, for example, lets you bound? The simplest statement I'll talk about is how it lets you bound things about the transmission of information. Suppose Alice wants to send a message to Bob. And the way Alice sends a message to Bob is the universe, the quantum system, is in some state, and Alice changes things somewhere. So she does some local unitary transformation on what happens. And Bob, sitting over here, makes some measurement. So he measures OB. And the question is, what's the difference between if Alice didn't do anything, Bob would measure OB. If Alice does something, Bob measures, you start with this UA, then you measure OB, and then you do this UA dagger. So Bob measures this OB in this change state based on this unitary operation Alice has done. Now, sorry, there should be a UA of T sitting in here. So what you can do is you can say, based on these Lieb-Robinson bounds, if this OB is outside this light cone, too far away, I can commute this UA through OB, then U dagger U gives me exactly one back, and so this difference is small. So if Bob is outside this light cone, then there's no way Alice can send information to Bob. So this is a kind of a limit on the transmission of information valid for a non-relativistic theory. You can also derive a similar statement, just a little bit stronger, a kind of a light cone for operators. You can say you take any operator at time t, any operator at time 0, and by integrating over various unitary rotations, what you can show is that here's an operator at time 0. The operator at time t can be well approximated by an operator that acts only within the light cone. So it's a closely related but slightly stronger statement. It says you put any operator down here, and its effect at time t is restricted to an operator that acts just within that light cone up there. So to exponential accuracy, you can write it as an operator which acts only on these sites nearby. With this kind of thing, you can derive bounds about how tough it is to produce correlations in the system. So suppose I start with a system that has some very small correlation length at time t equals 0. Perhaps it's completely a product state. There may be no correlations at all in the system. And then you ask, I evolve it under some arbitrary Hamiltonian evolution to try to produce correlations in the system. How long do I need to do it? Well, so I'm going to evolve it under this h of t prime from some initial time 0 to some final time t. And what I want to see is, can I make it so that operators OA at t and OB at t are correlated with each other? Well, what you do is you use these Lieb-Robinson bounds to propagate them backwards in time. And if their backward light cones don't intersect with each other, the expectation value of this operator with this operator at time t is equivalent to the expectation value of some operator on this light cone with some operator on this light cone. And since the initial state is assumed to be a product state, the expectation value of these can you hear me without this? Do I really need this? Oh, okay. Okay, well then I'll put it back in. So if the initial state is a product state, then these two operators won't be correlated at the final time if their backward light cones don't intersect. And again, these kinds of results are valid for very arbitrary Hamiltonians. So the result is, in order to produce correlations with a given correlation length, the time required is proportional to that correlation length, proportional to the correlation length divided by this characteristic velocity. Yeah, so gotta be careful here. So that's how long it takes to produce correlations. Now, how long does it take to produce topological order? So in order to do this, I want to define topological order a bit more accurately with some kind of errors defined. So we're going to define a set of states psi I naught to have topological order to some accuracy that I'll call epsilon comma L if, for every operator O supported on a set of diameter L, we have psi I O, this expectation value of O between these two states, minus some constant times delta I J is less than epsilon times the operator norm of O. So before I said, if for every local operator you get almost exactly the same result on every state. So now I'm defining almost exactly as to within this error epsilon, and local is local on some set of diameter L. So this is a property of the states. They don't need to be ground states of Hamiltonians, just property of states that these set of states are topologically ordered to this accuracy. And we'll say colloquially that they're topologically ordered if this epsilon is exponentially small on the system size, capital L, when this little l is of order the system size, but not quite. You say a quarter of the system size or something like that, but not large enough to have operators that go all the way around the system. Well, previously we say, you know, everyone has been saying topological order means that local operators have small matrix elements between the states and they have close to the same expectation value in all of them. So here I'm just defining how small and what it means to be local. So small is within this error epsilon and local is within this distance L. Well, so what do you mean within a band insulator? I mean, so if I have, let's say, a band insulator, which of course we don't want to be topologically ordered, we have the ground state, and now I define topologically ordered if I have a set of states. So you're going to have to come up with two. Now you could say, well, if I have a state that has an excitation here and a state that has an excitation here, I can tell them apart because I can have an operator that's supported just here that distinguishes them. So this is a way to distinguish them. And as far as I can tell, I think this includes everything we're calling topologically ordered and nothing that we're not. Now, suppose we start with some states, psi 1 and psi 2, that are topologically ordered to some accuracy, epsilon and L. And then we evolve it for a while. The question is, how well will they be topologically ordered at this later time? How good is the accuracy of this topological order at this later time? Well, so I evolve it under this unitary evolution, which is under some time-dependent Hamiltonian. You're making changes. Maybe you're turning on and off different gates in the system or magnetic fields or whatever. So the states go into each other with this unitary evolution. And now I put some local operator in again. I can use these Lieb-Robinson bounds. Well, all right, first I use the usual Heisenberg evolution of operators to say putting this local operator in at this later time is the same as putting O of t in at the initial time. However, I can then use the Lieb-Robinson bounds to say, well, this is the same as putting in, this O of t is still a local operator. It's been spread out. It's been spread out by an amount of order, this v times t. So it now, instead of sitting on some stead, it's been spread out to include everything in the like, but it's still a local operator. Since it's still a local operator, I know that these two states, the unitary evolutions, are still going to be close to topologically ordered. In the sense, so here's the idea. I started with some states that were topologically ordered, and that any operator on some set of a given size, like this big, would have vanishingly small matrix elements between them. Then at some later time, I can consider an operator that's on a slightly smaller set of states. I bring it back to an operator that's still on the same set of states at the initial time, and I say, well, it's still a local operator at the initial time, and so again, it will have vanishingly small matrix elements. The upshot is that if the initial states are topologically ordered to this accuracy epsilon and L, the final states are topologically ordered to the accuracy epsilon plus some small thing that's exponentially small in this length L, times some L minus VT. So the length scale has been shrunk. This is a lower bound. So you know that they're topologically ordered at least with this accuracy. And if the initial state is topologically ordered in this colloquial sense, so this little L is of order of the system size, then this is also of order of the system size, unless the time itself is of order of the system size. So the meaning is the following. You start with any states that are topologically ordered in the sense that local small compared to the system size have almost the same expectation, you evolve for some time. If that time is small compared to the system size, then the final states are again going to be topologically ordered, no matter how you do it, no matter what your Hamiltonian is. So now, this is kind of the question about how long it takes to produce topological order. Now I want to talk about what happens if you deform a system, if you try to change things. So I'm gonna shift gears a little bit. And imagine that I have a Hamiltonian which depends upon some parameter. So I have I call this parameter S. Yeah.
So what if you have a state on the sphere?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so in order to derive the Lieb-Robinson bounds, I needed a local Hamiltonian in this sense. So as soon as you do that, you're changing the metric because you're putting sites that are far apart nearby. So so at every step, the Hamiltonian you're evolving needs to be a local Hamiltonian. Turns out you can pass classical information faster than that, but you have to have a bound on how fast you can pass the quantum information in the Hamiltonian. So I have some parameter-dependent Hamiltonian. So S will be a parameter. So it will be H of S as S goes from 0 to 1. And typically, H of 0 is going to be some simple state, one of these model Hamiltonians I talked about earlier, and H of 1 is going to be some real system. And let's assume that there's a gap from a ground state sector to excited states that's at least delta for all these values of S. So the gap stays open under this evolution. So in a sense, we would like to say that this is the same phase, because we can connect them without the gap closing. We can connect them without going through a critical point. Thus, we would like to say, you know, in the usual sense, that you can go from water to steam if you go around without going through a critical point. In the same sense here, we can go without going through a critical point. So how does the ground state evolve, and how does the topological order survive under this kind of evolution? The first thought you might do is to think about going from the ground state of this H of 0 to the ground state of this H of 1 using the usual adiabatic evolution. You slowly change your Hamiltonian from first the Hamiltonian H of 0 to then the Hamiltonian H of 1. You have a time-dependent Hamiltonian. So at time t, H of t is one of these H of s's, where s is t over some t naught. And then you evolve your initial state under unitary evolution with this time-dependent Hamiltonian, and you try to slowly change the Hamiltonian. And what you would think is that if this t naught, which is the time you do it over, times the gap is large compared to 1, then using usual adiabatic results, this should give me something close to the ground state of the final state, because this is adiabatic evolution. Unfortunately, it's not very good for proving theorems about how things evolve, because the error in how close this system is to the ground state scales as some power of 1 over t naught delta e. And it also scales with the system size. So when you start dealing about macroscopic system sizes, in order to really get something that's close to the ground state, you have to go incredibly slowly. The time t needs to not just be of order 1 over the gap, but it needs to be many times 1 over the gap. So I'm going to discuss a better way of doing it, where instead of getting some error that's just a power law small in t naught delta e, it's going to be exponentially small in delta e. And this is what I call quasi-adiabatic evolution. So there's a fair amount of math on this slide, so I'm just going to quickly skip through what happens here. If you wrote down how does the ground state change with respect to S, what I've written here is just linear perturbation theory. You have some sum over intermediate states psi A, you have matrix elements to these states psi A, and you have an energy denominator. You can write this linear perturbation theory as integral d tau. This is when I say partial of H S with respect to S plus, this is the positive energy part of it, the part that raises it in energy. This is the negative energy part. And I take it at imaginary time I tau, and integrating over this with respect to tau generates exactly the desired energy denominator. So this is some equivalence. And then the idea is to define a local approximation to this positive energy part, and I'll tell you how you do that. And what this gives me in the end after defining a local approximation is some operator up here that is going to be a local Hermitian operator acting on it. So what I claim is that I can define, and I'll also claim that this approximation will be exponentially accurate, that the error will be exponentially small in how big I make this local approximation, so how much I have to spread this Hamiltonian out, that this will give me a very accurate approximation and tell me that the change in the ground state wave function with respect to S can be represented as some local Hermitian operator acting on psi. So this is the claim. And precisely the way to do it is to find down here there's some time scale involved, which I call TQ instead of T naught. This is going to be what I call quasi-adiabatic evolution instead of adiabatic evolution. And the idea is that, let me just summarize the results. You have a ground state at some value of S. The change in the ground state with respect to S can be represented as some local Hermitian operator acting on the ground state. And the error involved is going to be exponentially small in this value TQ. At the same time, the length scale of this local Hermitian operator, this will use the Lieb-Robinson bounds, is going to be of order TQ. So this is the kind of thing we need. And what we'll wind up with is that we'll evolve psi I naught instead of evolving it under the adiabatic evolution of the last slide, we take this operator, which I'm going to call D, which is precisely this operator here, and we evolve it over S prime going from 0 to S, and we S prime order it. So this is going to be like a Hamiltonian evolution, but instead of evolving under the regular Hamiltonian, it will evolve under this quasi-adiabatic evolution operator. And the error involved will be exponentially small in this TQ delta E, even in the thermodynamic limit. Even when you take the system sizes to infinity, you can keep the error on local operators bounded under this procedure, and you can keep it exponentially small under this procedure. So just a brief aside, I've been saying some stuff that might be a little bit surprising. Throughout the conference, people have talked about, well, we drag this particle around this particle, and then I think for Nick's talk yesterday, some question arose, well, what kind of errors are involved in dragging it around? Maybe you dragged it around the wrong side if you actually build a quantum computer. And Nick was saying, well, the error involved in doing that should be exponentially small. This is physically, we think it should be exponentially small. Probably in any experiment, it would be exponentially small. If you try to just write down, though, adiabatic evolution under a Hamiltonian, where you drag it around under the Hamiltonian, you find that the errors are not exponentially small, at least as one is able to meaningfully bound them. So quasi-adiabatic evolution gives you, I don't know if it's just a mathematical trick or something else, but it gives you a way where, yes, we can drag it around in a way in which we can mathematically prove that the errors are indeed exponentially small. So this is a way of evolving the ground state into the ground state. If you're trying to involve, instead of the ground state into the ground state, you have a system with multiply degenerate ground states. It sends a ground state into some other ground state, some combination of the other ground states. So it induces some unitary transformation in the space of ground states. And this unitary transformation agrees with the usual geometric phase. It's a zeroth order in this time, TQ epsilon, where epsilon is the ground state splitting. So the result, can I ask how I'm doing on time? Okay, how much of a? Half an hour. Oh, okay. Well, 15 minutes and then 15 discussion. Good. Okay. So what I imagine is that I have some splitting between these ground states, epsilon, which is going to be very small. So if I have a structure of states where I have this very small splitting between the ground states and energies, and indeed, since the energy is a local operator, if the system is topologically ordered, then the splitting between these ground states better be small. It is this error epsilon. And then I have some gap to the rest of the spectrum. If the gap is this capital delta E, and I have this splitting epsilon between the low energy states, I can do this quasi-adiabatic evolution, and the quasi-adiabatic evolution will have exponentially small mixing to the states above the gap, and will just produce the usual geometric phase or non-abelian geometric phase for what it does to these ground states below the gap. So they precisely agree with each other. So basically, it does what you think it should, and it proves. Well, so adiabatic is this. So it's just you change the Hamiltonian. Quasi-adiabatic is I define this operator here in terms of this definition, that this is what this tilde means for any time TQ. And it evolves under this different Hamiltonian, which is basically this. So it's... So the thing is that I'm evolving it under a different Hamiltonian for quasi-adiabatic evolution, but I can prove that the error involved is exponentially small under quasi-adiabatic evolution, whereas just under adiabatic evolution, the error is much larger. So, Sure, that's what I wrote down on the previous one, yeah. What I'm doing is I'm getting to a wave function that will be an eigenstate of the desired target Hamiltonian, or close to an eigenstate of the desired target Hamiltonian. I'm not slowly changing the Hamiltonian to the initial to the final. I start with a wave function, which is one of the ground states of the initial Hamiltonian. Then I apply this local Hamiltonian evolution under a completely different Hamiltonian, this Hamiltonian that I wrote down here, this Hamiltonian D. And the final state is exponentially close to one of the ground states of the target Hamiltonian. But I don't do it by just changing the Hamiltonian linearly from the initial to the final. I evolve it under something else. That's what I was getting at. Physically, we always assume that when we slowly drag things around, the errors involved will be exponentially small. when we say try and drag one particle around another, and you say what happened if we dragged it the wrong side? And often physically we think, well, the error should be exponentially small when we do that. If you try to mathematically drag things around adiabatically and determine the error, as far as I can do, you don't get results that are exponentially small. You get much larger errors coming out. So quasi-adiabatic, you can prove that they're, you can't prove that they're exponentially small. At least I can't prove that they're exponentially small. Well, in some model systems, they do come out, actually. And in some model systems, they come out really bad. So I think because basically all the model systems you can solve lack dissipation. And I think it's the dissipation is the key to getting the exponentially small result out. So physically, we wouldn't evolve under this. We don't really know how to evolve under this. Physically, we evolve something that's close to the adiabatic but also has dissipation. If you just evolve under the adiabatic, you can't prove that the errors in doing things are exponentially small. And in some model systems, they come out to be quite large, in fact. So this is great for proving things about how the system changes under change in Hamiltonian because the errors are very small. This is unitary. This is unitary. It's just under a different Hamiltonian. Oh, in a real physical system, in a real physical system, there is dissipation. Yeah. Right, so it's dissipating as it goes. And that's why in a model system it's tough to do because you can't really, in the model system you usually put the dissipation in wrong. Maybe there's a way to get something out. But the nice thing here is I never need to put in any kind of dissipation. I can do purely unitary evolution and get exponentially small error. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so at every stage of this evolution, if I evolve for a certain time s, the state is close to an eigenstate of psi s. Of h of s. So I can, while I'm doing this, I can also have this Hamiltonian h of s sitting there. So what you may think of is that I have this Hamiltonian H of S. I have this state, which is the ground state of the system. Now, in adiabatic evolution, you just change the Hamiltonian and hope the ground state follows. Here, I can evolve under the usual Hamiltonian plus this other operator, which I've written down, and this other operator keeps them close to each other, keeps the ground state close to the desired one. So you would have to, in order to do this, you would have to add something else on. You'd have to add some other influences to the system in order to produce this quasi-adiabatic evolution. No, it's a property of how I define it, and it's close. It's closely physically related to the time scale, for example, in adiabatic evolution. I'm calling it TQ instead of T0, but it's how long I do it. The error is now exponentially small in this TQ instead of just power law small, but the locality of this Hamiltonian, it gets less and less local the longer TQ gets. It may be, I guess, because I guess again there you sometimes get these yeah really singular transport coefficients because of the lack of dissipation.
Exactly.
Right. So it may be very related.
Not the Hamiltonian, make it clearly not
interpretable
by doing this.
Yeah, but I do mess it up in a special way.
Well, right,
yeah.
Right.
So it might be interesting actually to see what this it might be interesting to see what this operator corresponds to in some integrable systems because I don't know, it might turn out that it's actually that you've induced the dissipation in a controlled way. I don't know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. I mean, so here's a very simple example. Imagine you have a particle, single particle, confined into a potential well. And so the wave function is exponentially decaying outside the well. And now you turn on an electric field onto the particle. So physically what I think is, in order for the particle to get out of the well, it has to go a distance such that the electric field, you know, such that it's gained energy. This is what I would think. The distance it would travel would need to be such that the field times the distance is equal to the depth of the potential well. This is what I would think. And I would say the probability of it tunneling that far out is exponentially small because of the localization of the wave function. However, if you just instantaneously switch on the electric field, you find that you generate matrix elements to excited states, which are already start outside the well. And Oh, so if you don't, you can instantaneously, sorry, yeah, the potential change is slow, but, so sorry, I'm thinking of it in terms of a flux language. So you can instantaneously switch on an electric field by just slowly ramping on a flux. So if you, sorry, I said this a little badly. Suppose the way, I'm going to induce a very tiny electric field. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try and gauge, I'm just going to change the Hamiltonian by a gauge transformation, actually. I said this wrong. I'm going to change the Hamiltonian by a gauge transformation right at the end of this potential well. So I'm going to put flux in by some gauge transformation. So the ground state should go to the ground state with just this gauge transformation induced near the end of the well. I'm going to put the flux in slowly, which means there's only going to be a small field present at any point. This should induce a small field, which means that the tunneling should be exponentially small in the field, which should be exponentially small in the rate, but it's not. It turns out to be larger. That may be possible then, I mean, if you do that, yeah, so then that would be different from simply changing the Hamiltonian linearly like this, because then you need to ramp it on very slowly at the initial time. You can't just step it like that. And you also, so possibly if you do it differently, you might, if you ramp it on slowly at the initial time, you might be able to get a better result than this. I don't know. I'm still not sure if you, let's talk about that, because I think there's still some difficulties. That's an interesting question. I don't know of any. I don't know of any. There may be. So, okay. So with this stuff in hand, you can discuss the stability of topologically ordered states when you change the Hamiltonian. So the idea is quite simple. You start with some Hamiltonian that's, say, exactly, you can exactly write down the ground states. So like the Haldane Hamiltonian or Roxar-Kivelson Hamiltonian or any one of a number of Hamiltonians where you can exactly write down the ground states. And then you perturb it to some more reasonable Hamiltonian that has various kinds of disorder present in this more reasonable Hamiltonian. And you assume that the gap between the ground state sector and the rest of the system remains open under this evolution. You don't assume anything about what happens to the ground states. You just assume that that gap remains open. Then you say that, well, I can represent the final ground states by quasi-adiabatic evolution, using what I was just talking about. And so you can represent the final ground states by evolution under some local Hermitian Hamiltonian, which is now this quasi-adiabatic evolution operator. So you can go further the talk, and I said that, well, evolving under any arbitrary Hamiltonian takes a long time to induce topological order or to destroy topological order, and that time is of order the system size. And the result, by combining all these statements, is that any finite change in parameters, if you start with a Hamiltonian that's known to have topologically ordered ground states, you make any finite change in the parameters of the Hamiltonian, which keeps the gap open in the thermodynamic limit, you'll have the same structure of topologically ordered ground states with only exponentially small splitting between them. So if I want to compare, there was this paper of Wen and Niu in the early days of the fractional quantum Hall effect, where they showed that to leading order in disorder, first order in disorder, just doing first order perturbation theory, that the split between the degenerate ground states was exponentially small in the disorder. This is a statement now that I'm making beyond perturbation theory. It's you make any kind of change in the Hamiltonian that you can dream up, and as long as the gap between the ground state sector and the rest remains open, then the structure of the ground state sector remains the same in terms of the level splitting between them, the fact that local operators have vanishing matrix elements between them, and everything else that that you knew. So these states are very robust and very stable. If you look at states with ordinary order, things are nowhere near as stable. So you can... Oh yeah, so that's a stronger statement. So this is a statement that as long as the gap strictly remains open, then everything is good. Yeah, there. In fact, there are ways you could describe locally closing the gap, and I think one can probably use this machinery to take care of some of these statements. So that's a stronger statement. Suppose you simply had a state with ordinary order. One of the results is that In ordinary order, you can talk about, well, what happens to the state if I don't close this gap? How does the structure of low-lying states changed? How robust are the low-lying states? And as an example, let me look at the transverse field Ising model. So I have some nearest neighbor SZSE interaction, and I have some transverse field. If this transverse field vanishes, then all the SZSZ correlators are identically equal to 1. You can use this machinery of quasi-adiabatic evolution to show that, so I've got a degenerate ground state in a gap. So long as that gap to the rest remains open, then there will always be some dressed operators which look like block spin operators, such that the dressed operators, which will be transformations of these operators, will always again be perfectly correlated with each other at arbitrary distances. So basically it's a block spin operator. You look at a large block and you ask whether the majority of spins are up or down. But in order to prevent the ground state degeneracy from splitting, you need to impose something like an Ising symmetry, because even at b equals 0, you have operators with non-vanishing matrix elements between the ground states. So what you can prove using this machinery is that if you have Ising symmetry of your perturbations, then unless the gap closes, the splitting between these two states is exponentially small. But without the Ising symmetry of the perturbations, you can't prove anything. So it's a weaker statement for ordinary order, but you can still say something about the robustness of states. The last thing I want to talk about is flux insertion. So in the fractional quantum Hall effect, for example, on a torus, you would have the one-third state, you would have 3 degenerate ground states, or approximately degenerate ground states. And Thallis and Geffen early on wrote this paper where they asked about why do you get a one-third quantization of the Hall conductance in the system? And the reason you get a one-third quantization of the Hall conductance in the system, so what I'm describing here is you put in flux, and as the flux you put in evolves 0, 2 pi, 4 pi, 6 pi, this is the evolution of these 3 different ground states, and then there's some set of states above the gap up here. And then these here, they actually turn out to be avoided crossings due to some amount of disorder in the system, but, you know, avoided at an incredibly tiny scale, so I didn't draw it in. And these are how the states evolve. And they said, well, if you put in flux really fast, you wind up exciting states above the gap. So this is going to give you, this is large voltage, you'll be in a nonlinear regime, you'll get a different result. If you put flux in very slowly into the system, you could potentially go down around these avoided crossings and always stay in this result, and you would find that the ground state periodicity with flux insertion was 1. But if you put flux in at any intermediate time scale, what you'll find is that the ground state periodicity is 3, and you'll go from this to here, back to here. The ground state will be periodic with a period of 6 pi, or 3 times 2 pi. And putting the flux in will drive the system between different topologically ordered states. So this is a bit like this idea of Oshikawa, that you might drive the system between different states in a spin system by, again, twisting boundary conditions, and is very similar to putting in flux, putting in gauge flux into the system. But again, for proving theorems, the usual adiabatic evolution seems to run into some trouble. So the idea is that one could use quasi-adiabatic evolution to study this problem. You could quasi-adiabatically evolve the flux parameter. And this kind of quasi-adiabatic evolution, due to some gauge symmetry in the problem, works perfectly even if the gap, this states above the gap, is only present at theta equals 0, even if these states dive down at some intermediate values of theta due to some kind of gauge symmetry present in these systems. And what you can do to do with that, I'm just going to state the result instead of going into it. Using this quasi-adiabatic evolution and flux insertion, you can prove a higher dimensional version of the Leib-Schultz-Matis theorem that says, and this is not the mathematically precise statement, but this is just the overall view. Suppose you have a gap at theta equals 0, and you apply quasi-adiabatic flux insertion. You provably create a state which has a different momentum than the ground state. And so either there were multiple ground states with topological order at theta equals 0, or there was symmetry breaking, or this gap delta E at theta equals 0 was small, wasn't that big, and how small turns out to be of order log L over L, which goes to 0 as L goes to infinity. So you either have gapless excitations, or you have topological order, or you have ordinary symmetry breaking. And this kind of argument is valid for any system, doesn't need to be a spin system, but any system with conserved charge at non-integer filling. So I'm just going to conclude with sort of an outline of what I've talked about. This is a collection of results that all result from combining these Leib-Robinson bounds, which have, as I said, been improved a fair amount recently, with a gap in the system. So you have some bounds on propagation of information in these systems, which just relied on the Leib-Robinson bounds. This was Alice sending the message to Bob. And then you have, for example, you can derive, combining it with a gap, you can say things about exponential decay of correlations in the system, that a gap implies exponential decay of correlations. You can say things about correlations in Fermi systems. At non-zero temperature, those always have exponentially decaying Fermi-Fermi correlations. You can talk about the stability of phases while the gap remains open. You can demonstrate existence of topological order in certain systems in higher dimensional Lebesgue-Mattis theorems. Some stuff currently working on is improved algorithms for simulating quantum systems, matrix products forms for the density matrix, and then this last one with Frank and Sergey, area laws for producing evolution, producing entropy under time evolution of an arbitrary system. And then there's a number of other interesting extensions that might come out. And I think one of the interesting ones is this geometric phase issue, that this quasi-adiabatic evolution produces the same kind of geometric phase as usual adiabatic evolution does. And one of the interesting upshots with that you can prove is that in the Hall effect, you can show that the assuming the gap is present just at theta equals zero, you don't need it everywhere just at theta equals zero, you can show, in fact, the quantization of the Hall conductance using extension of the usual kind of Chern number arguments. But now you use quasi-adiabatic evolution, you only need the gap present in one place. So let me conclude there. Thank you. Yes. So I'm not sure if this is answering your question. Under the assumption that the gap remains open, I can prove a lot. To prove that the gap remains open is very tough, and I don't. Yeah, I mean that would be a closing a gap in the sense of a level crossing. So I need there would be one point in this parameter space at which the gap went to zero because of a level crossing. If it were what I need a gap is that I do indeed need a gap at all values of this parameter. Now, what may be possible is if the gap only closes at one value of the parameter, this may provide a technique for continuing a phase through a first order transition. That this may no longer be the ground state, but you're able to describe states which are close to eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, which are continuations of the state in the first phase, if the matrix elements at this level crossing are small enough. So, what you're talking about is a level crossing, which means that the gap did go to zero somewhere. If the gap didn't go to zero, then it didn't. Then what you're describing couldn't happen. So there has to be a case where the gap went to zero. But it could go to zero right at a point. It could go to zero at a point at one particular value of parameters if it's a first order transition. No. I'm assuming that there is an open gap throughout that parameter. I'm not assuming anything about convergence of perturbation theory. No. I need to assume that the gap remains open, but that's all I need to assume. There's no radius. So the point is that this kind of procedure is beyond perturbation theory. So if I had some, let's say, two-dimensional space that I was moving in, or some complex space I was moving in, and there was a singularity over here, I would be in trouble if I tried to go through it. But I can go way outside of it and around in any way I want, so long as I don't. Assuming, yeah, and that. Oh yeah. Exactly. So I can't cross a phase boundary, but I can move in any non-perturbative way as long as I don't cross a phase boundary.
Mm-hmm. And in one case, the gap should go exponential on the linear system side, and the other case, maybe like the area or volume.
Right, yeah, so.
No,
usually the bound that comes out is the weaker bound, so in both cases you get the linear, unfortunately. Yeah, that's, I thought about that.
So, yeah, I'm still talking about this issue much and stuff. Like, so you, the level of costing is not really a problem for adiabatic evolution as long as you take the uniform data, like you did in my paper. But of course, I know you showed a bound that makes it theorem. So I'm wondering whether your notion of quasi adiabatic evolution is essential to prove the bound?
I don't know another way to do it. I mean, that doesn't mean there isn't another way to do it, as we were discussing.
You can use this
Yeah, so as I said, I gave the talk in reverse order to how the work was done. So first it was done on the Liebschultz-Mattis with flux insertion, and then with Xiaogang we realized that you don't need to just insert flux this way. You can make all kinds of changes in a Hamiltonian this way, and things remain local as long as you evolve under this quasi-adiabatic operator. And then with Frank and Sergey, we realized that, well, this is actually a general statement for sort of arbitrary evolution that some things remain local. So I gave it in the reverse order to how we did it. But yeah, so the way I'm doing it, I don't consider the matrix elements between this crossing. I can deal with any gauge. If you deal with the gauge, which is a uniform gauge, then the matrix elements vanish. But the other concern, as you mentioned, is that, of course, the gap to other states may close at non-zero theta. And if you want to look at the quantum Hall state, then you start worrying about avoided crossings because there's no uniform gauge available there. So then it's another reason to try to want a way to go around. But, yeah. Sure. So, so what I'm saying is something like this. So I start with some psi naught, and I have psi naught going to this. So I'm integrating with this operator d s prime as s prime goes from 0 to 1. And you may say, well, this s prime is like a time. So it takes you a time that goes from 0 to 1 as you evolve it under this operator. So it would be fine to add on something like h of s onto this evolution, or h of s prime. This won't change it at all. So I can add on an additional term, h of s prime. And so I can go d plus any constant times h. Because at every stage, at every value of s, I'm close to an eigenstate of h of s. So I can evolve it under d plus h of s, and then everything is fine. I can evolve it under the combined Hamiltonian. So what you may say is that if I just had this term, this h of s, this would be an adiabatic evolution from s goes from 0 to 1. So this would just be changing the Hamiltonian. Here, what I did is if I just did this, this would just be quasi-adiabatic. If I do both, I still get the advantage of having this quasi-adiabatic evolution operator sitting here, as long as that's there. So what you may think is that I change this Hamiltonian s from 0 to 1 under adiabatic evolution, but I added on this additional term here, which somehow plays a role of killing some of the excitations I create that I didn't want. I can turn it off. Yeah, I can turn it off abruptly and it's fine. Because this operator simply is the operator that induces a change in s. This operator, h of s prime, acting on a ground state of s prime, produces back the same state because it's an eigenstate of that. D of s prime acting on a ground state produces the derivative of the ground state with respect to s, so it changes it. So this just produces the transport I need. So yeah, so I can just turn this on, drag it, turn it off.
Okay, if there are no more questions.